You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including fewer buses, illegal nerve agent-like pesticides, and Ashland's new plan to prevent wildfires. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Emma J. Nelson, JPR's intern for the summer.
Emma J., you reported on the Rogue Valley Transportation District cutting back on its services by September. How'd this story come to you?
Yeah, this is actually a follow-up on some reporting Justin did back in late June, where the Trump administration was requiring public transit to assist with immigration operations in order to receive federal funding. And Oregon is a sanctuary state, so obviously transit districts in Oregon could not comply, which means that RVTD is not getting the funds that it needs in order to maintain its operations. It has laid off dozens of employees and is now getting ready to take an axe to its services just to keep running.
So what's changed since June?
Yeah, the service cuts are starting to be solidified now. Rogue Valley Transportation has already announced that Saturday services are going to be suspended indefinitely. And that routes with lower ridership may be suspended as well. Even Route 10, which Julie Brown, the RVTD general manager, she told me it was the heart of the district. Even that will see some changes.
And that's the one that runs from Medford to Ashland?
That is, yeah. And it currently runs every 20 minutes, but it's likely going to be switched to more of a 30-minute schedule. So everyone will be on a delay. In fact, they announced just yesterday that many routes will be switching to a more 30-minute schedule.
And when will all these changes be official?
The RVTD administration is bringing their proposal to the board on July 23rd, so that's just this next Wednesday. And it's looking pretty dicey based on what they've announced so far. They're currently on a 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. schedule to make sure everybody gets to work and back from work on time, but it's shifting to a 6 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. schedule, so that's shaving off 2.5 hours of ridership. Yeah. They're also reducing to just 6 routes, which is a lot fewer than before. And while the board will be finalizing the decision on July 23rd, the changes don't actually kick in until September 2nd. So hopefully you do have some time to figure out alternative transport.
Okay. Well, Emma J., thank you for covering that.
Yeah, of course.
Justin, you had a story about illegal pesticide use at cannabis grows in Siskiyou County. Can you tell us about what that is?
Yeah, so this month, the Siskiyou Board of Supervisors declared a local emergency over the use of these pesticides, which first caught law enforcement's attention because they were found in these bags that had Chinese characters, which suggests that they're imported probably and likely illegally.
And it's hard to tell what they are, too.
Yeah, yeah. They had to get a translator to actually find out what was on the bags. I spoke with the Siskiyou County Sheriff for the story, and he says he began finding these foreign-labeled pesticides around 3 years ago, and now at this point, they show up at around 80% of raids in the county. So it seems to be a growing and heavily used product. Recently, the county, you know, it's important to note, recently the county has seen an influx of Chinese nationals actually growing illegal cannabis, which there's been reporting in other states on this issue as well. And the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors called this a transnational criminal threat in their proclamation.
And the issue isn't that they're maybe from China, but that there are dangerous chemicals in these pesticides, right?
Yeah, that's the issue. So the sheriff had these pesticides tested, and lab results show that sometimes they can include really a cocktail of dozens of chemicals, a lot of them banned and pretty harmful to your health. 9 of the compounds identified have similar effects to chemical warfare nerve agents, according to the county.
Say that 3 times
fast.
Yeah,
right. Others are known to cause cancer. So these chemicals have been banned for a reason in the United States.
Yeah. Well, what do we know about the other health risks for workers and others who are in contact with these?
So the sheriff said that these pesticides are used as fumigants, so that they're burned and put into the air, which obviously can be very dangerous for those growing cannabis. But Also, the sheriff says that the chemicals are making it onto the product itself, the marijuana, and even into the legal market. The sheriff actually pulled over a truck from a legal cannabis company based in Southern California, and they were picking up shipments at these illegal sites in Siskiyou County. There was actually an LA Times investigation last year which looked at this issue, and they tested products for these chemicals, legal products, which they found, and they noted state regulators actually don't test for many of these chemicals. So these chemicals, they can also make their way into the water and the environment. So the county is saying that this is a real health concern, not just for Siskiyou, but for the whole state.
And in your story, you mentioned that the pesticides, these illegal pesticides, have become a risk for first responders.
Yeah, that was something I hadn't heard before. So the sheriff said that firefighters have actually received chemical burns from responding to calls at these sites, which he said are frequent, and now they're even kind of hesitant to respond because of the risks. So this emergency proclamation will provide more safety equipment to first responders. And it also seeks state and federal help, which seems to be working. As soon after we ran the story, I spoke with the regional EPA administrator, Josh Cook, and he says the EPA's law enforcement teams are really going to crack down on this issue.
We will go after the people who've made this mess, and we will take their money and make them clean it up. They cannot come into the United States of America with these chemicals and poison our water supply and think that the United States is not going to find them. People of Siskiyou County and the people of Southern Oregon have a right to clean air and clean water by law.
Yeah, so it looks like there's some movement on the federal level, but this is a pretty big problem. The sheriff said there are over 2,000 parcels growing cannabis year-round in the county, and they also don't know how these pesticides are making their way into the county, so it seems to be a border issue, which obviously Siskiyou Sheriff isn't in charge of. But it does look like the county and federal agencies are now taking it very seriously, and we could probably expect raids and investigations in the future.
And more reporting from you, probably, Justin.
Yep.
Roman, are saving the best for last? Is that what's happening
sure.
here? You reported on the final draft of a plan to prevent wildfire in the city of Ashland. Why is the city developing this plan?
Yeah, this is called a Community Wildfire Protection Plan. It's actually a plan that cities that are defined as at risk. There was like a congressional law passed a long time ago that basically said the communities that are at risk, if they want to be prioritized for federal funding or help, they need to have this community protection plan to describe how they'll be protected from wildfires. So the city had developed one back in 2004, and that was the
that's a while ago.
I know, it is a long time. It's been a long time. So now they're actually developing a updated version of that plan because things have changed a lot since then in the wildfire landscape. The city is constantly threatened by wildfires. There was the Neal Creek fire, just weeks ago that struck just near Ashland, and people were worried about that. We had the Alameda fire in 2020, which started in Ashland, and if the wind was going in the other direction, it could have been much worse for the city. They also talked about how the area around Emigrant Lake is a big risk for the city because it's county land, so the city doesn't have as much control, and it's kind of below the city where it's easy for the wildfire to spread there. So it's sort of only a matter of time before one really hits the city itself, and Ashland wants to make sure it's moving towards protecting the city from wildfire. Chris Chambers, who works for the Ashland Fire Department, said he wants to make this city a climate refuge, a place where people go to because of the increasing risks of climate change around the world. They also talked about how they want to make this the community's plan, not the city's. They kind of remove the city's logo from the plan, be more it's Ashland's plan to reduce wildfire, not what the city government is doing. It's this blueprint for reducing it. I know that Ashland has been sort of a model nationally for what it has been doing to reduce wildfires. So this is sort of the next step in going even further to kind of make sure the city is essentially like protected completely from wildfire.
So let's break it down. What's in this community wildfire plan?
Yeah, there are big, big goals here. I think the biggest goal and the big part of it is that they want to reduce the wildfire risk of 90% of the structures in Ashland within 10 years, which is a big undertaking. There are a lot of structures in Ashland, and a lot of them are pretty risky wildfire-wise. So, that's sort of what they have to do to make Ashland safe, as you'd call it. So they talked to a lot of community members over the years and a lot of business owners and stuff. And, they gathered and consolidated all of this input into what they call challenges. They have 44 of these challenges that the city faces. And these range from all sorts of things, including like rental properties, the renters have a lack of authority to implement these risk reduction changes, and property managers might not be willing to do them, to also concerns about safe and speedy evacuations. So then all of those challenges are then addressed by 200 initiatives to deal with all of these problems. So, you know, if we look at the above issues that I just talked about, some of the initiatives for renters are finding funding to incentivize property managers or encouraging them to require wildfire training for their landscapers. And then for evacuation routes, that could be including things like restricting street parking during red flag days, which is when wildfire risk is the highest, or, you know, coordinating with local schools or inspecting evacuation routes annually. So they've kind of gone over pretty much every aspect of wildfire prevention, all of the issues facing that, and then how to address those.
So who's going to be making all these changes?
Yeah, so like I had said, they want this to be a community plan, not a city government one. So ideally, this is like a combination of property owners, nonprofits in the city. So, you know, they might work with a community group, the city itself, but also a community group could look at the plan and be like, oh, this is something we could do. We could help, you know, low-income folks access landscaping incentives to, you know, reduce the wildfire risk on their property or something like that. So they also talked about how they pretty much need to hire someone to manage all of this stuff and coordinate this from a higher level. It could be a city employee, but it could also be like a partnership with an organization. But someone kind of needs to be there to build those partnerships and raise funding for all of this work.
And that sounds like it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah. The plan estimates that they're going to need to spend around $8 million annually over those 10 years to meet these goals. And to to clarify that, that's money that the city spends, that's money that the community groups spend, or that's just like money that a homeowner might spend to, you know, replace their landscaping with more fire-wise plants. So it's not just $8 million that the city has to spend itself.
And what did you hear from city council members?
Yeah, the city council members were hearing about this at a study session this week, and they were mostly positive. Some even seemed okay with having the city pay for a staff member to implement this. The city council mostly wanted to know what the city should be doing and how much that's going to cost them. There were also concerns about insurance and how they're going to ensure that insurers insure homes, because that's been a big issue with wildfires. And then there's also concerns about rental properties, because it sounds like property managers have not been as willing to make changes, and they don't just want to give money to landlords, saying that's not going to look very good for them. So how to work with them on this. So the council also kind of understood that they're going to have to make some hard decisions here in order to protect the city from wildfire. They're going to improve this plan in mid-August, and that's kind of when things will really, you know, hit the ground running.
And Robin, you also just published a story today about a program here in Southern Oregon that pays teens to get out in the forest and do ecological restoration. What is this program?
Yeah, it's this long-running, I think they're in the 13th year education program run by Loma Kotze, which does a lot of ecological restoration work in the region. They pay 16 to 18-year-olds to go out in the forest and do this ecological restoration work and learn about it. Usually there's 20 kids that take part in this four-week program every summer, but this year there were only 15. I got to go out while they were cutting back madrone saplings to kind of reduce wildfire risk. But they also do a lot of education. They bring in experts from tribes, government, other groups to teach them about things like ecology, botany, hydrology, all sorts of things, and kind of help them explore career paths in the field. And so they graduated from the program this week.
And so why did they want to participate?
Yeah, I talked to a couple of different students who are participating in this. It sounds like for most of them, it's because they're kind of already a little bit interested in a career like this, and they want to explore it more. I did talk to Stephen Rice, who's kind of up from the Eugene area. He didn't really know what he wanted to do. He said his aunt lives down here, and he heard about it through her, and then kind of came down here and learned that, oh, this is something that's really cool, and I'd like to do something about this.
Sounds like a teen thing.
Yeah, I talked to another person who already was, his parents do a lot of ecological stuff. I think one of them runs a solar panel company, and so he was already also doing trail maintenance through his mountain bike team. They have to do maintenance on the trails that they do, and so he wanted to learn more about this kind of work. And so a lot of the students who end up taking part in this program do end up kind of going on to this kind of work in the future.
Well, what exactly are they doing out there?
All sorts of things, like building fire lines, they're chopping plants, they're maintaining trails. A lot of the work has been in the Ashland watershed, but a lot of that work is done now, so they're kind of moving on to more stuff around the region. Like they went to Crater Lake and went to the Klamath River to look at the dam removal and fish hatcheries and stuff. So it's kind of giving them a broad variety of experiences. I know that a lot of the teens just said that they really enjoy just being outside and doing hands-on stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Roman. That was a great story, and glad you could bring that to us. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform.